From the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, this is Democracy Now! War, Peace, and the Presidency, breaking with convention.
Cutting our health care, taking away our freedom to control our bodies, the freedom to become a mother through IVF like I did, those things are not going to improve the health outcomes of our wives, mothers, and daughters.
Michelle and Barack Obama headlined the second night of the Democratic National Convention here in Chicago. We'll look at the Democrats' emphasis on protecting reproductive rights. Then we'll hear from an American doctor just back from Gaza.
So we call for a ceasefire and a stopping of the bleeding by stopping the sales of bombs. There's no reason that the bomb that dropped on that young woman's head had to be made in America.
And we'll talk to former Democratic Congressmember Andy Levin. He is a former synagogue president who was defeated 2 years ago after AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, spent millions against him.
If we start letting another party pick our nominees, we're done. There's no integrity to our party. What do we stand for? And the majority of money that AIPAC is spending in Democratic primaries back in a special election in 2021, in 2022, in 2024, is coming from Republican billionaires.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. We're breaking with convention. I'm Amy Goodman. In Chicago, night two of the Democratic National Convention centered around Kamala Harris's sweeping economic policies, which include addressing the housing crisis, canceling medical debt, and banning grocery price gouging. Democrats held a ceremonial roll call to nominate Kamala Harris as president and Tim Walz as vice president. Harris accepted the nomination virtually in Milwaukee, where she and her running mate, Governor Walz, addressed a packed arena, the same site where the RNC was held last month. The second night of the DNC here in Chicago was headlined by former First Lady Michelle Obama and former President Barack Obama.
We do not need four more years of bluster and bumbling and chaos. We have seen that movie before. And we all know that the sequel is usually worse. America's ready for a new chapter. America's ready for a better story. We are ready for a President Kamala Harris.
Other speakers at the DNC last night included Senator Bernie Sanders, who called for expanding health care access and raising the minimum wage. He also addressed Israel's war on Gaza.
We must end this horrific war in Gaza. Bring home the hostages and demand an immediate ceasefire.
During President Obama's speech, Jody Evans, co-founder of the anti-war group Code Pink, unfurled a pink banner inside the DNC that read, "Free, Free Palestine." She was then escorted out. An array of anti-Trump Republicans also took to the stage last night to plead their case for Harris, including former Trump White House press secretary Stephanie Grisham. Police arrested dozens of people Tuesday night outside the Israeli consulate in Chicago as police clashed with demonstrators demanding an end to Israel's war on Gaza. This is protester and Chicago resident Jonathan Bell.
We are starving the people. They are bombing schools and hospitals. And the people here are protesting to say that that's not right. And the United States should not be aiding and abetting a terrorist like Netanyahu. He is a terrorist, and his cabinet, who are calling for the starvation and the annihilation of the Palestinian people, It is a terrorist act on the part of Israel.
Elsewhere in the UK, five activists were handed prison sentences of between 12 and 16 months Tuesday after occupying the Thales weapons factory in Glasgow, Scotland. The group Palestine Action says 16 of their activists are in prison as a result of their actions to stop the genocide in Gaza. Disgraced New Jersey Democrat Senator Bob Menendez has resigned from the U.S. Senate in the wake of his convictions for bribery, obstruction of justice, and acting as a foreign agent for Egypt and Qatar. The once powerful head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is scheduled to be sentenced October 29th and faces up to 20 years in prison, though he says he's appealing his conviction. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy tapped George Samir Helmy to fill Menendez's seat until the results of November's election are certified. Helmy is Murphy's former chief of staff. Democratic Congressmember Andy Kim is facing Republican hotelier Curtis Bashaw on the ballot. Panama's government has begun the mass expulsion of undocumented immigrants on U.S.-funded flights. On Tuesday, Panamanian officials deported at least 29 Colombian migrants who had crossed into Panama through the deadly Darien Gap. Panamanian President José Raúl Mulino has made blocking asylum seekers from crossing the Darien jungle a central issue in his government. In July, Panama unveiled a deal with the Biden administration to deport more migrants in the region. Migrant deaths along the U.S.-Mexico border have continued to surge due to extreme heat and harsher border enforcement policies that have forced asylum seekers to cross through more remote and dangerous regions. In Arizona, officials warn this year is likely to set another dire record of migrant deaths in the Sonoran Desert as humanitarian aid workers are repeatedly targeted by border agents. This is Pima County Medical Examiner Gregory Hess.
Last year in 2023, I think we recovered about 190 some total remains. This year, we're basically on the same pace as we were last year. We always get more remains in the summer. So I think we've recovered about 105 remains so far this year, and probably half of those have been in the last 2 months.
In New York City, dozens of migrants who'd been sleeping in a makeshift camp on Randall's Island were forcibly removed by police Monday as the city intensifies its crackdown on asylum seekers. Rights groups have slammed New York City Mayor Eric Adams' policies that have pushed hundreds of asylum seekers out of shelters, forcing them to sleep on the streets. On Tuesday, state officials approved the eviction of about 30,000 migrant parents and children staying in city facilities. The Legal Aid Society said, quote, treating people who have come here seeking asylum and safety like they are threats is incomprehensible in what's supposed to be a sanctuary city. To see Democracy Now!'s extended discussion on the Democratic Party and the issue of immigration, we've expanded to 2 hours all week during the Democratic National Convention. Check out our other hour at democracynow.org. A new report by Human Rights Watch has accused the city of Los Angeles of implementing a, quote, cruel, expensive, and ineffective policy of criminalizing unhoused people. The report says Los Angeles's systematic sweeps on the dwellings of unhoused people only serves to remove them from public view and focuses on punishment and quick fixes rather than addressing the dire housing and care needs they face. This is Michelle, one of the unhoused people featured in Human Rights Watch's video accompanying their report.
They woke us up this morning telling us that they're going to do a clean sweep and that to grab what we can and to get out because they were taking everything else. They take our food. They took all my underclothes. They took all my shoes. They leave us with no resources. So we're stuck here until we can manage to get something to eat or clean water or whatever it is because they don't care.
As a result of L.A. policies, death rates of unhoused people have skyrocketed, with an average of more than 6 unhoused people dying in Los Angeles County every day. A black person is 6 times more likely to be unhoused in L.A. than a white person. The situation is likely to get even worse as California Governor Gavin Newsom recently ordered local authorities to remove encampments following a Supreme Court ruling which criminalized sleeping in public places. In Bosnia, three educators were killed in the western town of Sanski Most earlier today when a gunman with an assault rifle opened fire on a high school. Firearms have been common across Bosnia since the conflicts of the former Yugoslavia in the 90s. However, mass shootings are rare. The United States has imposed sanctions on former Haitian President Michel Martelly for drug trafficking and money laundering. A U.S. official said the sanctions against Martelly underscored the, quote, destabilizing role he and other corrupt political elites have played in perpetuating the ongoing crisis in Haiti, unquote. Martelly was Haiti's president from 2011 to 2016. This comes as the U.N.-backed Kenyan-led police force deployed to Haiti almost 2 months ago appears to have made little inroads in addressing the spiraling insecurity and gang activity in Haiti. In Ohio, a judge denied a request by residents of East Palestine to have more time and information before a deadline tomorrow to accept a $600 million class action settlement with Norfolk Southern over last year's train derailment. Residents near the site of the disaster can also claim up to $25,000 per person for personal injuries as part of the deal. But accepting the money means they will give up their right to sue in the future if residents develop cancer or other serious illnesses due to chemical exposure. Earlier this month, the Associated Press revealed cleanup workers in East Palestine became sick with headaches and nausea, but their health conditions were kept hidden from the public. In other environmental news, students at two Maryland schools in Harford County have been told to avoid drinking school water over concerns about levels of chemicals known as PFAS. The widely used substances are referred to as forever chemicals and have been linked to a host of health conditions. PFAS are present in many foods, common household materials, and waterways. And in related news, the U.S. Air Force has refused to comply with an EPA cleanup order after the Air Force polluted drinking water sources in Tucson, Arizona, including with PFAS. The Air Force cited the Supreme Court's ruling overturning the four-decades-old Chevron doctrine earlier this year. In May, the court's far-right majority stripped federal agencies of the authority to enforce its interpretation of a law, leaving judges with broad latitude to determine how environmental laws are enforced. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. We are breaking with convention. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. We're broadcasting from the studios of CAN TV here in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. In Chicago, Democrats held a ceremonial roll call at the Democratic National Convention Tuesday to nominate Vice President Kamala Harris to be president, along with her running mate, Governor Tim Walz. Harris accepted the nomination virtually from Milwaukee, where she and Walz addressed a packed arena, the same site where the RNC was held last month. The second night of the DNC in Chicago was headlined by former President Barack Obama and former First Lady Michelle Obama. This is part of what Michelle Obama said.
She understands that most of us will never be afforded the grace of failing forward. We will never benefit from the affirmative action of generational wealth. If we bankrupt a business or choke in a crisis, we don't get a second, third, or fourth chance. If things don't go our way, we don't have the luxury of whining or cheating others to get further ahead. No. We don't get to change the rules so we always win. If we see a mountain in front of us, we don't expect there to be an escalator waiting to take us to the top. No. We put our heads down. We get to work. In America, we do something. And throughout her entire life, that's what we've seen from Kamala Harris. The steel of her spine, the steadiness of her upbringing, the honesty of her example, and yes, the joy of her laughter and her light. It couldn't be more obvious. Of the two major candidates in this race, Only Kamala Harris truly understands the unseen labor and unwavering commitment that has always made America great. Now, unfortunately, we know what comes next. We know folks are going to do everything they can to distort her truth. My husband and I sadly know a little something about this. For years, Donald Trump did everything in his power to try to make people fear us. See, his limited, narrow view of the world made him feel threatened by the existence of two hardworking, highly educated, successful people who happen to be black. The job he's currently seeking might just be one of those black jobs. Look, it's his same old con. His same old con, doubling down on ugly, misogynistic, racist lies as a substitute for real ideas and solutions that will actually make people's lives better. Look, because cutting our health care, taking away our freedom to control our bodies, the freedom to become a mother through IVF like I did, those things are not going to improve the health outcomes of our wives, mothers, and daughters. Shutting down the Department of Education, banning our books, none of that will prepare our kids for the future. Demonizing our children for being who they are and loving who they love. Look, that doesn't make anybody's life better. Instead, it only makes us small. And let me tell you this, going small is never the answer. Going small is the opposite of what we teach our kids. Going small is petty, it's unhealthy, and quite frankly, it's unpresidential.
What they unleashed on her family?
That was former First Lady Michelle Obama at the DNC on Tuesday night. She then introduced her husband, former President Barack Obama, who repeatedly criticized Donald Trump.
As we gather here tonight, the people who will decide this election are asking a very simple question. Who will fight for me? Who's thinking about my future, about my children's future, about our future together? One thing is for certain, Donald Trump is not losing sleep over that question. Here's a 78-year-old billionaire who has not stopped whining about his problems since he rode down his golden escalator 9 years ago. It has been a constant stream of gripes and grievances that's actually been getting worse now that he's afraid of losing to Kamala. There's the childish nicknames, the crazy conspiracy theories, this weird obsession with crowd sizes.
Former President Barack Obama speaking at the Democratic National Convention Tuesday night. When we come back, we'll look at how Democrats have been focusing on reproductive rights here at the DNC. We'll be joined by Professor Michelle Goodwin. Stay with us.
I'm fortunate to be alive. Can't explain how I got here, but we've arrived. The deliverance and diligence for which we strive. It's the feeling, there's no silliness when we rise. Fortunate to have friends who don't synthesize. I keep good company, we enterprise. Had a strong gauge since infantized. I guess I can see the power in the prize. Incentivized by the streets I identified. Other people's struggles I don't minimize. Fortunate to be born and raised in the shy. Salt of the earth people with the bravest eye. They say your God is the truth, I wasn't raised to lie. Fortunate to be so case of rye. Every day that I get up, I trace the sky. Draw with the most high on the place that I am. And that's fortunate, you can feel it in the air. And yo, it's love out there. Hey, the feeling is free. Yo, Chi-Town at the DNC. Jonathan, what you say?
Keep you near the cross, and may your troubles show that you need God, and may your battles end the way they should, and may your bad days prove that God is good, and may your trials.
Chicago native Common singing Fortunate last night at the DNC with Jonathan McReynolds. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez.
On Tuesday night, the Democratic Party held a ceremonial roll call to nominate Kamala Harris as president. During the roll call, Texas was represented by Kate Cox, who was introduced by former Planned Parenthood President Cecile Richards.
Proud to be here tonight representing a tradition in Texas of progressivism and my late mother, Ann Richards, the governor of Texas, and passing it on to another great Texas heroine, Kate Cox.
I'm Kate Cox, and I love being a mom. I have two beautiful children, and my husband and I have always wanted a third. But when I got pregnant, doctors told us our baby would never survive. And if I didn't get an abortion, it would put a future pregnancy at risk. But Trump didn't care. And because of his abortion bans, I had to flee my home. There's nothing pro-family about abortion bans. There's nothing pro-life about letting women suffer and even die. Today, because I found a way to access abortion care, I am pregnant again. And my baby is due in January, just in time to see Kamala Harris sworn in as President of the United States.
That was Kate Cox speaking for Texas during the DNC's ceremonial roll call to nominate Kamala Harris as president. She was introduced by Cecile Richards in the Texas delegation. Cecile, former head of Planned Parenthood, now suffering from brain cancer. On Monday night, three other women who've been impacted by abortion bans addressed the convention: Hadley Duvall of Kentucky, Caitlin Joshua of Louisiana, and Amanda Zarofsky of Texas, who was joined by her husband, Joshua.
When you're expecting a baby, packing for the hospital should be a joyful moment. For us, it was different. We were told with 100% certainty we would lose our baby girl, Willow. And we were sent home. For 3 days, we waited until Amanda was sick enough to receive standard abortion care. Eventually, Amanda's temperature spiked. She was shaking, disoriented, and crashing. I don't remember what I threw into our bag that day, only that instead of welcoming Willow, I was hoping Amanda's life could be saved. I'm here tonight because the fight for reproductive rights isn't just a woman's fight. This is about fighting for our families. And as Kamala Harris says, our future.
Every time I share our story, my heart breaks. For the baby girl we wanted desperately, for the doctors and nurses who couldn't help me deliver her safely, for Josh, who feared he would lose me too. But I was lucky. I lived. So I'll continue sharing our story, standing with women and families across the country. Today, because of Donald Trump, more than one in three women of reproductive age in America lives under an abortion ban. A second Trump term would rip away even more of our rights. Passing a national abortion ban, letting states monitor pregnancies and prosecute doctors, restricting birth control and fertility treatments. We cannot let that happen. We need to vote as if lives depend on it, because they do.
Two years ago, my husband and I were expecting our second child. Our daughter, Lauren, couldn't wait to be a big sister. I was getting ready for her fourth birthday party when something didn't feel right. Two emergency rooms sent me away. Because of Louisiana's abortion ban, no one would confirm that I was miscarrying. I was in pain, bleeding so much my husband feared for my life. No woman should experience what I endured, but too many have. They write to me saying, "What happened to you happened to me." Sometimes they're miscarrying, scared to tell anyone, even their doctors. Our daughters deserve better. America deserves better. Kamala Harris and Tim Walz will fight for reproductive rights and our freedom and our shared future.
Growing up, I was an all-American girl. Varsity soccer captain, cheerleading captain, homecoming queen, and survivor. I was raped by my stepfather after years of sexual abuse. At age 12, I took my first pregnancy test, and it was positive. That was the first time I was ever told, "You have options." I can't imagine not having a choice. But today, that's the reality for many women and girls across the country because of Donald Trump's abortion bans. He calls it a beautiful thing. What is so beautiful about a child having to carry her parents' child? There are other survivors out there who have no options. And I want you to know that we see you. We hear you. Kamala Harris will sign a national law to restore the right to an abortion.
That was Hadley Duvall of Kentucky, Caitlin Joshua of Louisiana, and Amanda Zarofsky of Texas, joined by her husband Joshua, speaking at the Democratic National Convention Monday night. We're joined now by Michelle Goodwin, professor of constitutional law and global health policy at Georgetown University, host of Ms. Magazine podcast on the issues with Michelle Goodwin, and author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood. Thanks so much for being with us. So we just listened to these horrific stories, how women are affected by abortion bans. And yet you have President Trump just recently saying that abortion is no longer a factor in elections, saying he believes it will end up being, quote, a very small issue in this year's election.
Well, he's not paying attention to what's taken place since the Dobbs decision, which is something that he set in motion by the nominations that led to Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett, these justices being on the United States Supreme Court, and their overturn of Roe v. Wade and also Planned Parenthood v. Casey. Because in the wake of this, what we saw immediately was a 10-year-old girl needing to flee one state to get to another in order to terminate a pregnancy that was due to rape. And there were lawmakers right after that immediately said, these were anti-abortion lawmakers that said, it's a hoax. She doesn't exist. This can't be. And then when it was revealed by a very crafty reporter who was in the courtroom when the person was being charged, then they said, well, there are protections in this state. There are protections for rape and incest. And they did not exist. Lawmakers very specifically crafted abortion bans that made no exceptions for rape or incest, a bridge that 5 years ago would have seemed too far. But with Donald Trump in office and what he put forward, I want women criminalized who have abortions. I'm going to put judges on the Supreme Court and lower federal courts that are going to get rid of abortion. All of that was something that we could see coming forward. And if I could just add to that, what lawmakers have done who have been part of an anti-abortion movement, they have actually heard from doctors that have come forward and said, I've had an 8-year-old patient who was pregnant. I've had a patient who has a fetus with no skull. I have a patient who has a fetus with no brain development. I have patients that are about to die, and lawmakers turning a cold, blind eye to that. That's the reality post the Dobbs decision.
Yet at the Republican convention, abortion hardly came up, and it was scrubbed from the party. Any mention was scrubbed from the party platform, even in the face of public support for abortion rights continuing to grow. How do you think this is going to play out in this coming election?
Well, there have been political strategies that are now taken up by some on the right, including Donald Trump. He's very interested in winning this election, and so he's publicly said, look, let's tone down what's our rhetoric on abortion. Let's get through this election. We have to count votes. And the reason that he's taken that posture is because in 2022, in that midterm year, there were these predictions that there was going to be the red tsunami, the big red wave. People were ignoring reproductive freedom. And yet I kept saying, what mother wants to look across the table at her 10-year-old daughter and say, you will not have an option for the future that you deserve because of a rape from a neighbor up the street or in this family? No. And what we saw is ballot initiative after ballot initiative, whether in red states or blue states, that reproductive freedom was prevailing. And we've seen that since this time. So that's why, in part, on the Republican platform, there's not much mention with regard to abortion or even pro-life stance. Very different from the Democratic platform.
But there will be ballot measures in this election. I think Montana became the 8th state on Tuesday to put the issue on the ballot. Arizona. What the impact of these ballot measures on turnout?
Well, on one hand, what these abortion ballot initiatives have meant is that they've all won. They've all been towards reproductive freedom. At the same time, I think what's really important for us to understand is that there have been efforts to thwart what has done. I mean, there are the collections of 500, 600, 700,000 signatures, 800,000 signatures to get these ballot initiatives in front of voters. And yet there have been tremendous efforts to try to undermine that. And we have to keep that in mind, that voter suppression still exists in the United States. This is not voting where everyone just gets to cast their vote. And that has to be understood. Just as there are more ballot initiatives, there have been more and more efforts to suppress votes and to gerrymander certain communities out of being able to vote.
Clearly, the conservative anti-abortion forces are running scared. Arizona, the court just ruled, yes, this constitutional amendment can be on the ballot. But I feel like it's like more than a decade ago when all over the country, conservatives put anti-gay marriage, anti-what we call now marriage equality amendments on to vote in states because it would get people to come out and then, because they felt impassioned about that, to vote for conservative candidates. Now, because these are pro-abortion ballots on the states in like eight states, it will get people to come out who will then also vote for Democratic candidates in some of the most conservative states.
Well, this, here's what's interesting, is that, yes, that's going to take place. And there are people who are part of the Republican Party, we've seen this, that are coming forward who are men because they understand that this is a tipping point for our democracy. What we've seen with the suffering of women and girls, near-death experiences, people being helicoptered out of Idaho in order to save their lives during pregnancy, is that they are the tip of the arrow. Their blood is on the tip of the arrow about our democracy, and that we have to understand. And so, yes, folks are going to come out for these ballot initiatives, and they're just going to come out because they actually see that the platform that's been put forward by Democrats in this instance are ones that support democracy. And just for our clarity to understand just what this path has been, Roe v. Wade was a 7-2 decision. Five of those seven justices were Republican appointed. Justice Blackmun, who wrote the opinion in Roe, was put on the court by Richard Nixon. Prescott Bush, the father of George H.W. Bush, was the treasurer of Planned Parenthood, the national treasurer. And George H.W. Bush himself shepherded Title X through Congress. What was that? Providing reproductive health care for the poorest of Americans. And Richard Nixon then said, this is just basic public health care. So the Republican Party itself has come a long way from its origin story supporting reproductive freedom.
We just have a minute to go. What do you think are the most important issues right now to talk about in Chicago at the Democratic National Convention, what you want to hear?
Well, I think what we want to hear is that we want to save and preserve our democracy, that civil liberties and civil rights matter, that these issues are interconnected. And Amy, I said it on your show 2 years ago, and I've been saying it. When the Dobbs decision came down, that was a decision that was a punch in the gut to American democracy itself. When Justice Alito said, just go vote, Justice Alito was not paying attention to the fact that this case, or he was, that this was a case that came out of Mississippi. 60 years ago, it was Fannie Lou Hamer before the National Democratic Convention that talked about the Mississippi appendectomy, being dragged off a bus, she and other black women, all because they wanted to vote, being beaten, taken to a jail, and being beaten by the inmates at that jail, men, and then a guard taking a baton and beating her in the head. And Fannie Lou Hamer said, all of this just because we refuse to be second-class citizens. All of this because we just want to be able to vote. And so these issues are interconnected, and I think her story is a beacon for understanding the trajectory of what we need for American democracy.
Michelle Goodwin, professor of constitutional law and global health policy at Georgetown University, host of the Ms. Magazine podcast on the issues with Michelle Goodwin, and author of the book Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood. Coming up, we'll hear from an American doctor just back from Gaza. And we'll talk to former Democratic Congressmember Andy Levin, a former synagogue president defeated 2 years ago after AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, spent millions against him. We're in Chicago at the DNC. Back in a minute.
I think I loved you. The sea, and you were the shore, like the tourist comes back to the beach. I come
Love Letter from the Sea to the Shore by Delaney Bailey. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. I'm Amy Goodman here in Chicago with Juan Gonzalez.
In Gaza, at least 50 Palestinians have been killed in the last 24 hours as the Israeli military continues its assault on the territory and expands its ground operation in Deir al-Bash, Abala. Over 40,200 Palestinians have been killed and nearly 93,000 wounded over the past 10 months.
Here in Chicago, a group of American doctors treated patients in Gaza, gathered on Tuesday for a press conference here at the DNC inside the McCormick Place Convention Center. The press conference was organized by the Uncommitted National Movement. Among those who spoke was Dr. Ahmed Youssef, who just returned from Gaza 3 weeks ago. This is some of what he had to say.
My name is Ahmed Youssef. I'm a double board certified internal medicine pediatrics doctor focused primarily in the ICU. I come from Arkansas. I may have a hard time doing this. I went to Gaza about 3 weeks ago, came back after being there for about 3 weeks. I primarily worked in the ICU and in the emergency room in Al-Aqsa Hospital. I thought, I'm not a politician and I'm not a military strategist, but the moment we drove through Rafah with a UN convoy towards the middle area where we were going to be stationed, it became clear to me that what I was seeing was unfathomable. And at the same time, I had a small hope that when the doors are open and the ceasefire is had, that when you all are allowed back in there, that it doesn't require a military strategist to realize what they're doing. They're making Gaza unlivable. They've destroyed the water infrastructure, and so we were seeing kids die of diarrheal illness. They prevented all medical supplies in, and I can tell that by firsthand witness, not by hearsay. They refused me the medical supplies that I was able to gather over months from wonderful people in Arkansas, things like endotracheal tubes and Foley catheters, things like antibiotics and sedative medications that were denied at the border. First-hand experience. They do not allow medical supplies into children that are dying. And when we got to the hospital, everything I saw on TikTok and Instagram and all the Telegram, all the stuff that we had from alternative media, because you can't be there, it was 100 times worse than I could have ever imagined. I have no ties to Gaza. I'm not from there. I have no blood there. But those people treated me better than I deserved as a member of the international community. With no food, they tried to feed me, and they'll tell you the same. With no food, they tried to feed me. And when I asked them what we could do, because there was so little we could do as doctors, they said, just make sure people know we're here. I'm going to mention the names of some of the girls that were in medical school that were with me. There was Lena, she was a fifth-year medical student. There was Rahaf and Rahab, they were sixth-year medical students. There was Fatin, who just graduated from medical school. These young women were displaced 4 or 5 times before I met them. They lived in tents, sometimes areas in the red zone, which means they were free target practice if they crossed the roads. And they came every day to the hospital to learn because their schools had been completely stopped. And they would take that trek every day knowing they could lose their lives, knowing that the value they presented to their families as medical people could be lost because they wanted to come and help in whatever way they could. On the first day I was there in Al-Aqsa Hospital, we were in a small trauma bay in the ER. And when the first mass casualty, which was one of almost one every day I was there, occurred, and we could hear the bombs in the distance, and we knew that about 45 minutes later, people would come in pieces, that children would be carried in pieces by their loved ones on donkey carts and in ambulances, 4 or 5 in one ambulance. There was a young woman who got laid up right next to the young boy I was treating. She was 22 or 23 years old, full body surface area burns. And she was unable to speak because she likely had inhalational injury because the same burns that burned her skin likely burned her airway. And a woman screamed from outside the door, "Hamil, she's pregnant." And so we turned her over quickly because she had come in, lay down on her belly, and somebody put an ultrasound probe on her belly, and she had a viable 18 to 20-week pregnancy. But when we did our secondary survey and tried to understand what other injuries she had a shattered tib-fib from an explosive injury. She had burns that covered over 70% of her surface area, which is a death sentence in an environment where you can't find gauze and there isn't clean water and there aren't antibiotics. We all knew what this meant on the ground in the trauma bay the first minutes we met her. She was going to die there, and her baby would die there. And there was nothing we were going to be able to do about it because the Israeli government and the IDF had made it impossible to care for people to the extent which they deserve. Every human being deserves the right to medical aid in that situation. She was no fighter. She was a pregnant woman who was sitting in her home when a bomb dropped on her head. And she eventually moved to the ICU. And every day she lived until she died, she was in pain. Because we didn't have the kind of medicine we needed to care for her pain. And when wound care came in America, I'd give her 2 Dilaudid before changing her wound dressings. And there I could give her nothing. And every morning when we'd round, we'd stop by her bed first. And every one of us and the Gazan medical professionals who are heroes that one day will get to be here and tell you their stories themselves so I don't have to tell it for them. We'd all keep our mouths shut and keep the tears held back because we knew we couldn't do anything and we knew the inevitable was coming. Until one day I walked in and the bed was empty. And her story is just one of tens of thousands. And her family mourned for her just like we would mourn for our own family members. And she and every single person in Gaza deserves the dignity and support that humanity as a whole is burdened and has an obligation to provide. I stand here, and I'll conclude with this last thought, which is the reason I lose sleep and the reason we cry tears isn't sadness anymore. It's a feeling that we have no ability, despite being from the most powerful country in the world, providing the bombs that drop on these innocent people, that we have no power to stop the bleeding. And so we call for a ceasefire and a stopping of the bleeding by stopping the sales of bombs. There's no reason that the bomb that dropped on that young woman's head had to be made in America.
That was Dr. Ahmed Youssef, who just returned from Gaza 3 weeks ago. The news conference he was a part of was organized by the Uncommitted National Movement. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. I'm Amy Goodman here in Chicago with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to look at how AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, has spent millions targeting Democrats who have criticized U.S. support of Israel. In June, AIPAC and affiliated Super PAC spent almost $15 million to defeat New York Congressman Jamal Bowman. And then 2 weeks ago, Missouri Congressmember Cori Bush lost her seat after AIPAC spent $8 million to defeat her. We're joined now in Chicago by former Democratic Congressmember Andy Levin of Michigan. In 2022, he lost his House seat after AIPAC spent millions in dark money to defeat him. Levin is a former synagogue president and self-described Zionist. Despite this, AIPAC labeled him as, quote, arguably the most corrosive member of Congress to the U.S.-Israel relationship.
Andy Levin is a former Democratic Congress member from Michigan. He's part of a political dynasty. We thank you so much for being with us. If you could start off by talking about, you know, when we hear about Bowman, we hear about Bush, you came before them, and talk about the race that unseated you. Might surprise many that you were a synagogue president and a Congress member, and how you were driven out.
Right. Well, I had been a synagogue president until I went to Congress, and I felt I should stop doing that because, you know, you have to devote all your time to Congress. And I had, mezuzahs, the little things that Jewish people hang on their doors, on all my doors in Congress. I'm a really, like, joyous Jewish person. And they, you know, I think they felt particularly threatened by that, Amy and Juan. The idea, and plus my dad and my uncle had served in Congress before me, my dad in the House, my uncle in the Senate. My dad was the president of the high school class of 1949 at Central High School in Detroit, right? They were from the bosom of the Jewish community there. And I think that these right-wing on Israel people can't stand the idea that a Jewish person like me, who is fully for self-determination for my people in the Holy Land, was the loudest voice in Congress saying, well, that's not going to be sustainable, and we're not going to have peace there until and unless we fully realize the human rights and the political rights of the Palestinian people, too.
I just want to talk about your family dynasty, the political dynasty.
We don't talk about it like that.
Your father, Sander Levin, the Congressmember, your uncle, Carl Levin, head of armed services in the Senate.
Yes.
At the same time, your father was head of Ways and Means Committee?
Yeah, these two Jewish boys from Detroit, and my uncle, who passed away, never left the city of Detroit. They each served 36 years in Congress. They served 32 years together. In the 235-year history of our elected democracy in the United States, they are by far the far longest-serving siblings, even more than the three Kennedy brothers, more than anybody. And I'm so proud of them and their contributions to our democracy. But, you know, Uncle Carl got crosswise with AIPAC in the 90s when Yitzhak Shamir was, I think, the second Likud prime minister of Israel. And he said, land for peace. We're not doing land for peace. And Carl, it may feel naive today, but he was like, oh, my gosh, that's the basis for any hope of peace. And he wrote a letter to Secretary of State George Shultz, I think it was at the time. And he got 30, on a Friday afternoon, he got, I think, 30 senators to sign this letter. It was supposed to be private. And they sent it to him saying, we have to have land for peace. Do something about this, something like that. And one of the other senators or their staff made it public. Carl had shown the text to AIPAC beforehand. But when it went public, AIPAC went crazy, said, this can't be Carl Levin's letter. They demanded he retract it. They said it must have been the work of some staffer. Uncle Carl totally stood by his staffer who helped him write the letter. He said, no, that's my letter. And anybody who knew Uncle Carl knew he went over every line, you know, himself before they sent the letter. And so, you know, this is, look, if you are a Jewish person and you really want to be true to your faith, you have to treat the other as yourself. You have to love the stranger, the neighbor. The most oft-repeated mitzvah or requirement in the Torah, I think 36 times, which is a very significant number for Jews, is some version of that. Who is the most important other for us, honestly? If not, okay, a homeless person, someone who looks different than you, you know, yes, treat them well. But really, I think the acid test for Jewish people is how do we treat our Palestinian cousins? And so we have to treat them as we would want to be treated. They are from the land. They're there on the land. And if you come from Michigan, you know so many amazing Palestinian Americans who are your neighbors, your colleagues, your doctor, your friend, you know. And so we need to all get along there, and we need to work together here to make that happen. And I don't care what AIPAC does. You know, it's outrageous that they're using money from Republican billionaires to decide who wins Democratic primaries. That's a problem for democracy, and it's a threat to the soul of the Democratic Party. Even from a kind of a dry political science point of view, right? If you are in a political science class and your professor says, well, there's multiple parties, right? And they each have to choose their candidate that represents that party's values or beliefs to go up against some other party, right? If any party lets a different party, interest groups from a different party, billionaires from a different party, come and choose its candidates, it's kind of finished.
Well, I want to ask you, you mentioned Michigan, where you're from. Talk about the rise of the uncommitted movement and what kind of impact it's had on the Democratic Party and on the process of choosing a president.
Juan, I am so proud of this movement. These are young people. This is a true grassroots movement. I remember when I went to a phone bank that they had during the Michigan primary, which our primary for president was way back on February 27th. The energy in that room, the beautiful rainbow of people in that room, the food that someone had cooked. You know, if you're an organizer in the social movements of this country, when you walk into a situation like that, you know if something has life, is authentic, has power. And not only did they get over 100,000 people to vote uncommitted in just a few weeks in Michigan to say to President Biden, we want to vote for you in November, but you've got to change course on Gaza to help us do that. It obviously went national, too. And I'm so proud of these young people because I don't want Donald Trump to get anywhere near the White House ever again. But even now, in late August, I feel like Vice President Harris, I hope that she can sort of reach out more. And it's difficult as a vice president, right? But I think she has plenty of space to say, look, under a Harris administration, we're going to follow U.S. and international law on military aid to Israel and all of any other military aid, right? And she could say she has a lot of room to say different things that would win the support of the uncommitted movement, which I think it would be very helpful to win Michigan, which is necessary.
Very quickly, you were on this panel, Palestinians and Jews, elected officials, that was the first DNC, first ever panel on Palestinian human rights held on Monday.
Yes.
And we played a part of that on Democracy Now! The demand of many in the uncommitted movement has been to have a Palestinian speaker on the stage of the Democratic National Convention.
Time. Yeah, during prime
Do you
time.
Expect that to happen?
We're still holding out hope. I'm actually grateful. I understand that hostages' families will be on the stage tonight, I think. I'm grateful for that. You know, it's horrifying that Hamas took hostages. It's totally a war crime, right? That should be exposed. But my goodness, you know, with 40,000 people dead, 15,000 children dead, 19,000 children orphaned, 1 million children displaced, for our party to have a Palestinian-American speaker to talk about this, I think would be a really positive thing and indicate growth for our party. I think, Kamala Harris is going to be our next president. She needs to be. There's no president in this century, two Republicans and two Democrats, who's actually moved the ball forward for peace in the Middle East in a significant way. I need Kamala Harris to be that president who changes that dynamic. I think she can be. We're hoping that she really finds a way to express that in this convention and afterwards. Having a Palestinian speaker in prime time would certainly be a positive thing, and we're still hoping for that.
And finally, you mentioned billionaires of the other party. We just have 20 seconds. Explain what you mean, deciding Democratic primary candidates.
Right. Well, so it's, you know, there's a lot we have to do to get dark money out of politics, right? Citizens United. But it's up to the political parties to set their own rules. So within Democratic primaries, our party, our leaders in the House and Senate could set rules to say, no, if you're running for the U.S. House or U.S. Senate as a Democrat in a Democratic primary, we don't want and we're not going to let Republican billionaire dollars in here, and that would be better for our party.
We're going to have to leave it there. Andy Levin is former Democratic Congress member from Michigan. And that does it for our show. We've expanded to 2 hours every day from the Democratic National Convention. To hear or watch our other hour, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez from Chicago.